Chapter 40, Jorgen. Jorgen was losing this war. He'd thrown everything into a final battle because, after much deliberation, the Coalition had determined that Spensa was right. Their best bet was an attack here, where the enemy kept its slugs. So they'd struck, aiming to liberate as many Tanix as they could, struck with the hope of freeing Spensa, their most volatile but most impressive weapon. This had been his one chance at turning the war around. And he was losing. He was no expert at large-scale battlefield tactics, but neither was he a slouch. Even before going to flight school, his education had required him to understand and practice command. During flight school, he'd been given officer's training on the same principles. So he could see what was happening. Reaching enough inhibitor stations to move detritus was impossible. It required spreading his forces dangerously thin. Even if the slugs would agree to let it through, there were just too many. In front of him, the battlefield was an agitated nest of red and blue dots, but his forces in red were penned and pushed backward consistently. The enemy forces in blue were ever advancing, sweeping out to the sides, leaving room only directly behind the Defiant for a careful retreat. Each one of his ships that winked out was a spike through his heart. His forces were now completely on the defensive. It was time for him to make the call. Time for full retreat. Which was tantamount to giving up the war. They'd never have another opportunity like this. Their next best option was to go into hiding, hoping they could escape the notice of the superiority. They'd have to abandon their allies. And Spensa. He'd have to abandon Spensa. You have to think about the good of your people right now, he thought, not the good of one person. It hurt nonetheless. He turned away from the large wall screen in the command room, walking through silence. Most of the rear admirals and even the aides had seen it. The room held its collective breath as he approached the back of the long table, where the Kitsan generals and admirals were waiting. They'd set up a second battle table on top of the larger, human-sized table. None of them sat at it, though. They'd instead spread notes, maps, and schematics on the ground around them and were speaking softly. Jorgen's pin chirped translations at him. Possible. Yes, this is right. This is right. Suggest a reposition here and here for maximum effect. Jorgen steeled himself to ask for their suggested method of retreat. But as he did, Ichika, the Kitsan supreme tactician, drew his attention. She was distracted by something, going over some message. Goro stood beside her, and the general wore his power armor despite being nowhere near the front lines. Goro looked up with wide eyes. He had a fearsome black streak down the top of his otherwise gray and white fur. Admiral, wait, he said. You have to see this.
See what?
Captain Nightshade's suggested battle plan, Goro said, gesturing to some Kitsan-sized papers on the tabletop. She's found an answer. A simple one that we didn't see, as we are too new at using cytonics. It's a path to victory, another of the Kitsan said, standing up. A chance, an actual chance.
Explain it to me, Jorgen said, daring to let hope flutter alive within him.
Jorgen, Grangran's voice said from a small datapad on the table. Is that you?
Yes, Captain Nightshade, he said, tapping his ear and opening a direct line to her.
They've told you about my little idea? She asked.
They seem impressed by it, Jorgen said, but I don't know the details.
Well, she said, we just need half the fighters to sweep back behind the Defiant and contact the inhibitor stations there, while the other half act chaotically and move in too close to the enemy capital ships.
That will leave you exposed, Jorgen said. Without fighters to defend the Defiant, the enemy can bring down your shields.
Yes, she said. They keep pushing forward with incredible aggression, foolhardy aggression.
You want to try to get those slugs behind the Defiant to let detritus hyperjump over, Jorgen said,
leaning down, looking at the tiny Kitson maps. He probably should have pulled them up on the screen, but he was too excited.
We've been considering that, but we'd have to contact at least 50 of those inhibitor stations at once. It wouldn't work.
Impossible, Goro agreed. But this is something else, Admiral Waite. Something daring.
Detritus isn't merely a planet, Grangran said. It's a planet with 1,000 floating platforms. What would it take to hyperjump only the portions of the shell that have our gun batteries on them? Those are far smaller. Ship size.
Scud, Jorgen said, meeting Goro's eyes. Was it possible? The gun emplacements had their own crews these days and had always contained their own power sources. He should have thought of this after finding that solitary platform on Erdale.
We need to get Rig on the line, Jorgen said. This might be possible. But, Captain Nightshade, the enemy will guess what we're doing if we try this. And those platforms will be incredibly exposed without Detritus's defenses.
This plan accounts for that, Ichika said from nearby. See how the enemy focuses? All we need to do is keep their attention. An aide presented Jorgen with a datapad with the full details of Grangran's plan. It had been hastily annotated by the Kitson, who had added actual tactics and movements to Grangran's short message. They had the battle experience. But Grangran, despite lacking all that, had something almost as important. Guts.
It is a dangerous gamble, Goro said. There is a good chance the enemy will see what is happening, despite the distractions we offer, and this plan will collapse. But then again, our enemy commander is brash, young, thirsty for victory. You can see it in her every order. She might not be careful enough. If so,
this could be huge, the other Kitson said. Do we risk it? Jorgen didn't answer until he'd read through and understood Grangran's suggested battle plan. What she was outlining finally clicked. And with horror, he realized what it would cost.
This,
he said, looking to the Kitson. One at a time, they all nodded, understanding.
It is what must be done, Jorgen, Grangran said. It's the only way.
We recommend following the course Captain Nightshade has suggested, Goro said. Retreat now will be extremely costly and will put us into an even more difficult position going forward. However, we have agreed to your leadership in this battle. We will do as you decide.
Jorgen took a deep breath and didn't make the decision yet. Instead, holding on to the plan, he walked to the side of the room and sat down in one of the seats there, leaving the aides to stand by the table looking uncertain. Cobb leaned forward from within the shadows where he'd been sitting, bags under his eyes, looking so much older than he should have.
Did you read it? Jorgen asked, tapping his data pad.
Just finished, Cobb said.
I think you should decide, Jorgen said softly. Cobb, you have the experience, the age, the wisdom.
Cobb snorted softly.
You think age brings wisdom, son? If it did, I wouldn't know so many old fools.
Cobb, I'm doing my best, Jorgen said. But I can't help thinking that I'm too young for this. Someone more experienced should make the decision.
Becca Nightshade has at least 30 years on me, Cobb noted. And it's her plan.
He leaned forward farther.
But Jorgen, this shouldn't be about age. We put you in charge, me included, because we trust you. This battle, this war, this victory, it leads us to a brand new world. You think any of us old fools know what to do with a new world? We've struggled for generations against an unmoving wall of destruction. We've thrown ourselves at that doom time and time again. It made us hard of will, yes, but hard of mind, too. That's why I stepped down. My health was an excuse and a good one, but I knew, and still know, that I wanted someone who can embrace a better life to lead us. Not someone who wore himself out squeezing every bit of hope and joy from recruits so he could throw them into the fire.
Cobb looked at him then, and Jorgen saw echoes of those words in his face, his eyes. How must it have been, spending decades training new flight after new flight of pilots, only to watch them die in waves facing the Krell? Hundreds of kids he'd come to love, dead, month after month. All while knowing he had to train more, had to keep sending them off to the same fate. Jorgen had always seen Cobb as strong, immovable, and he was strong. But strong men could still be used up. Jorgen rested his hand on Cobb's back and understood. Someone else needed to carry this burden now. Someone else needed to make this decision, hard though it was.
"Send to Captain Nightshade," Jorgen said, steeling himself and standing. "Commend her for her genius, and tell her to move forward with honor and defiance."
Chapter 41.
"There," Braid said, pointing to the hologram. "There. Push everything we have right there. They're starting to flounder. Half their fighters are running away. They're abandoning their flagship, and the rest are a scattered mess, breaking formation. We can capture the Defiant."
"Yes, sir," the general said, nodding to the others.
"We'll send in the gunships. Everything," Braid said.
"We send in everything. We have to crush them. Not just their bodies, General, but their spirits. And the spirits of any who would ever presume to raise arms against us. We are not just fighting for victory today. This has to be a symbol."
I saw her reasoning, yet it seemed brash, even flagrant to me. And I was the girl who consistently took off running in gym class before the coach finished their instructions. Something felt off about this battlefield, though I couldn't pick out why. Were our forces giving up too easily? I didn't have time to ponder it as Braid turned toward me. I stiffened, hands held carefully behind my back, feigning that I was still locked in place.
"It's time," Braid said.
"Sir?"
a Dione aide asked.
"Time for what?"
"For me to be certain we have backup," Braid answered.
Even with the drugs in my system, I could feel a faint, cytonic vibration from her. She was contacting the Delvers. I strained against my chemical constraints, wishing I could hear what she was saying. And in this, I understood why Braid felt she could be so reckless with her forces. She had another weapon at the ready to support them, and she was calling it in now. At long last, after centuries of struggle and failed attempts, someone was finally going to successfully weaponize the Delvers. All it had taken was access to me as a threat. I prepared to rush her. Perhaps, even though she was staring at me, she'd be distracted by her cytonic communications, and well, if I got shot, that would still accomplish something important. Braid would lose her bargaining chip with the Delvers. It twisted me in knots to realize that the best I might be able to accomplish right now was getting myself killed. I steeled myself for the attack anyway, and just before I leaped up and charged her, a voice pushed into my head.
"Hey!"
M'Bot said.
Chapter 42. M'Bot. One thing confused Mushroom Bot. He couldn't figure out why the Delvers had left themselves so vulnerable. As he moved among them, he had opportunities to blend with them. It was a difficult experience to parse. He wanted to record what was happening to him for later digestion and explanation, so he tried. But how to express it? The Delvers passed through one another constantly, a kind of assessment to make sure they all still matched. The way biological entities had defenses on the cellular level looking for dead, malformed, or broken pieces to destroy. This constant nudging against one another, blending and checking, helped keep them all the same. It was also one of their big weaknesses because, as he'd theorized earlier, it could be used to spread a pathogen among them. His tiny test proved it. He could set off a chain reaction, one that created a new model that they all came to copy. Except he feared that with something large, they'd notice this flaw, and they'd use their system to smother the new model instead of adopting it. That was what the system was designed to do, after all. Identify a virus and make sure it was exterminated. Ensure all Delvers remained exactly the same. So how? How could he turn the Delvers' system of conformity into the weapon that would destroy them? He still didn't have an answer, but the pain, that was the second key. He went over what he knew again. They all felt it just beneath the surface, commented out but still relevant. It was still raw whenever too much of the somewhere leaked in. That passage of time, that knowledge of place, somehow made the pain surface again, like a pool of frozen blood beneath melting snow on a warm day. He liked that metaphor. He made special note of it. Even though Spensa hadn't seen much snow, he figured she'd like this comparison for the blood part. But the Delvers, why? Why leave themselves exposed like this? They'd created a barrier of forgetfulness between themselves and their pain, but they could have deleted their pain entirely. Why hadn't they? That question drove him as news from the somewhere leaked in. That allowed him to keep track of time and gave him urgency. He could read the superiority side of the battle and hear them pressing against his friends, boxing them in, preparing to destroy them. Spensa was once again trapped and drugged. He could maybe push through that, as the drugs made her an ordinary person, but Cytonics like him could talk to regular people, with effort. He also saw that Braid was preparing to activate the Delvers. Time was running out. He needed to know the secret. He needed to understand why the Delvers hadn't just deleted this part of themselves. It would be so easy to... As he brushed against several Delvers, melding with them and using his fabricated sense of Delverness to fool them, he finally saw it. He got enough of a glimpse of their former code, their souls, to understand. They couldn't erase the pain without erasing him. This person they had loved long ago. This person they had, in a way, been created to love. They would let themselves forget him to dull the pain, but they had not been able to bear erasing his memory entirely. And so they lived a terrible contradiction. They'd fled here to escape the pain of loss, but the idea of being completely separated from the one they had lost was far, far more painful. They hovered, therefore, with the blade halfway to their hearts, piercing the skin but not digging any deeper. He still needed another answer, though. And so, he did the daring thing. As he'd learned while traveling the nowhere with Spensa, he could choose. He chose now. He hadn't been able to find the answer, so he needed to risk himself to get it. "Why?" he asked as the others bumped into him. "Why do we fear her?" This question immediately identified him as a deviant. None of the others were thinking this. They saw him as a Delver, not as himself, so his camouflage was working. But he appeared as a Delver who'd been corrupted by the pinpricks of somewhere that leaked through. They came at him, smothering the question, trying to get him to turn his thoughts toward theirs. He dared not change, however. He dared to keep asking. "Why?" he asked. "I've forgotten." When he didn't change, when he was firm, others began to ask, too. This was the problem with their protocol. So long as the question was reasonable, it could infect them. Others pushed through, providing an answer to smother his question. "She can destroy us," they thought. "She is danger." "Why?" "The somewhere. The somewhere. A being of two worlds. She can..." She could bring the somewhere into this place. in force. She could make time move. And now, he had the solution. She spanned both realms, somewhere and nowhere. She could bring to this place time, motion, and annihilation. If she brought the somewhere in force, the thin protection the Delvers had against their pain would wear out. It was flimsy. It wasn't meant to last, but it could survive here, outside time. And without it, like blood seeping through a bandage, the pain would come. The Delvers would be paralyzed. Poor things. He knew them enough now to empathize, but he was, well, if not a soldier, then a soldier's friend. He knew this had to be done. Unfortunately, Spensa had been cut off from her powers again. He could feel her, though, so he waited until Braid inevitably called to the Delvers, which weakened the barrier, making it easier to get through to Spensa. In that moment, he got a single word through. Hey! She didn't reply. He sensed only a fogginess from her, far thicker than he'd felt before. Unfortunately, that meant he had to make his own plan. How fun, and how daunting. Having agency was kind of terrible, actually. But he settled on a solution for now. And that was the time-honored battle strategy of stalling. Chapter 43. Gran Gran.
Sir, Beowulf said from Becca's side. This last order is authorized by command, Becca said, right hand feeling at her map. Report to your transport and leave the ship. We can't abandon the Defiant, Beowulf said. The computer can handle the rest of the maneuvers, Becca said. Obey your orders, Lieutenant.
No footsteps. Becca was about to reiterate her order when she felt the younger man embrace her. A sudden, unexpected warmth in this difficult time.
Go, Becca said. Now.
The final member of the bridge crew retreated, footsteps sounding loudly when he reached the uncarpeted hallway outside. Checking her map, Becca saw that the starfighters were following her commands, pulling away, as if driven into chaos by the enemy. Half backward, half forward, feigning disorganization, feigning fear. But actually, approaching the inhibitor stations behind the ship, talking to their slugs, pleading with them. That left the Defiant, the newly rebuilt symbol of their people, alone and undefended. Becca took her hand from the map and stood up, new carpet scrunching underfoot. She stared ahead, toward the enemy she knew was there beyond the hull, beyond the vacuum, watching from her own side.
Come on, Becca said. You've thrown everything you have at killing me. Here I am.
Her hull shook as the ship, using an automated firing pattern, launched barrage after barrage as it withdrew, too slowly. Only one engine was on out of the four, and sparks sprayed from another, because Becca herself had ordered explosives detonated there. A classic feint, pretending they were breaking down from pushing their equipment too hard. The Defiant was a symbol, yes, and as a symbol it represented something, a concept that would not die no matter how many ships were destroyed. The enemy general didn't realize this. They'd proved it by committing so much to attacking the ship. Now Becca provided what that distant general hoped to see, fighters scattering outward and abandoning the flagship, transports fleeing. A beleaguered vessel, so tempting.
Come on, Becca said, as she turned the ship as if to flee for safety. You think you've beaten me. Now come in for the kill. I dare you.
Chapter 44. Braid.
Make this mean something.
Those had been the last words Braid's father had ever spoken to her.
Make this mean something.
His words as they'd pulled his frantic child away from him. Her parents had been executed 3 years later, She wasn't supposed to know. But she'd found the official death report, which said they'd been put down. Apparently, they'd gotten out and frightened someone important who had revoked the permit for keeping them. To this day, she wasn't certain if Winzik had been behind it. No parents meant no other influences on her, something that had become increasingly important as he'd realized how powerful a cytonic she was. He'd been brutal for a Varvax. She would almost miss him. Too bad he'd never realized that she wasn't fitting into his plans, but the other way around. Today was the culmination of her work as she reached into the nowhere and approached the Delvers. Make this mean something. Yes, it would all mean something when a human, after centuries of trying, finally conquered the galaxy. The Delvers were hiding, like they always did these days. Before, when she would come into the nowhere, their eyes would appear, glaring, potent, intimidating. Now she seemed to be alone, though she could pick them out around her, watching, seething, with the quiet burn of embers cooling after a fire was out. "It is time to make good on your promises," she said to them. "Join us in this battle." She'd agreed to use them only in an emergency, but she needed to make a splash and intimidate her own forces to ensure no one got the idea to do to her what she'd done to Winzik. "If we come, you will destroy the abomination?" they asked. As usual, they thought and responded as one, a million different voices speaking at the same time. "I will not let her torment you," Braid said. "That is all I promise for now. If this goes well, if you can distinguish between my forces and the enemy, then we'll see. For now, I want 10 or so of you here in my realm, ready to fight my enemies." 10 might have been extreme, but Braid needed this to be a symbol, a day to remember. She would release the footage of this battle carefully, showing the dangers of the insurgents, but also obliquely showing her strength. Today, at long last, she made her parents' sacrifice mean something. Today, she...
Excuse me?
One of the Delvers said. One, a singular Delver. It opened up a burning white eye to look her over, less timid than the others. It was an incongruous experience. Never before had she singled out one of them. Never before had one acted out of line with the others. "Yes?" she said.
"Yeah, I don't believe you," the Delver said.
"Don't believe?"
"That you have the human abomination, as you claim."
"I showed her to you," Braid said, exasperated.
"Could be an illusion or a trick," the Delver replied.
"An illusion or a trick? Can't you sense her?" Braid asked.
"Not right now," the Delver said. And to this, the others seemed to agree, though they also seemed baffled by the behavior of this one.
Some Delvers were showing individuality now. The leaking of the somewhere into their realm was influencing them, making them deviate from one another. With a growl, Braid changed her focus so she could see the somewhere overlapped by hints of the eyes and the Delvers. She stalked through the room and seized Spensa by the collar, displaying her for the Delvers.
"Here she is," Braid said. "We have her drugged to prevent her touching your realm. She'd be too dangerous otherwise."
"I don't know," the strange Delver said. "She looks suspicious."
"Looks suspicious?" Braid frowned, dropping Spensa.
"What are you?" she demanded. "What is going on?"
"Sir,"
a voice called, distracting her.
"You should see this."
Braid ripped free of the nowhere to glance at the hologram. The Defiant was turning and running. It had stopped firing, stopped maneuvering, and was trying to escape in a last mad push to get out of the inhibitor field. The starfighters had fled, and the escape transports were in chaos, pulling back from it, leaving it exposed, leaving an opening for Braid's forces.
"Hit that ship with everything," she said, rushing over to the hologram. "The battle is ours. Bring that ship down."
"It's working," General Halaki said. "You were right, sir."
Braid watched with satisfaction as her fleet pulled inward, focused on the Defiant, hitting it repeatedly and finally beginning to overwhelm its shield. Explosions broke its surface, ripping off sections of the hull. Victory at last! Except a strange sensation distracted her from her satisfaction. The air was warping. Not again. Was the drug wearing off so quickly? She twisted and looked toward the wall at Spensa, who was pulling a needle from her own thigh, where she'd injected an entire syringe into her bloodstream. Braid's hand flew down to the pouch at her belt, which was unzipped and empty. Oh, scrud.
Chapter 45. On one hand, injecting myself with a random syringe I found on my enemy was, well, one of the most Spensa-like things I'd ever done. On the other hand, I felt an immediate fire spread through my veins, and my senses expanded. It was like the antidote was burning away the wall between me and the nowhere. By the time Braid had noticed what I'd done, my powers had returned. We locked eyes. The air warped around me, the Delver inside me cutting through inhibitor fields like a knife through fat. I leaped forward, then hyperjumped. But I didn't run for safety. I didn't teleport to Detritus or to my friends or to the Defiant. I teleported only a few meters, straight to Braid. I appeared above her, like an avenging saint with wings outspread, and seized her throat. My momentum carried us forward, and I slammed her down to the ground, then pulled back a fist. When I rammed it toward her face, however, she vanished. I dropped the short distance to the deck, twisting to find her directly to my right. She ripped her sidearm out, but I slapped her hand and teleported the gun out into the vacuum of space. She vanished to avoid my next punch, appearing behind me, but I hyperjumped myself, next to one of the startled Tanasi guards. I tore his rifle from his hands, flipping off the safety and spinning to level it toward Braid. I fired three destructor rounds in a burst, straight into the wall behind her as she vanished again. Shrewdly, she teleported beside me. That got her inside my reach, so she could grab the gun and try to twist it out of my hand. I grunted as the guard stupidly tried to grab me from behind. I teleported him into the vacuum outside next to Braid's gun. I struggled over the rifle with Braid, sweating, our eyes locked, not speaking. And scud, she was taller, more muscled, and stronger than I was. She forced me back, slamming me against the wall, then began to wrench the gun free, a smile on her lips. But she didn't realize. I was used to fighting people bigger and stronger than I was. My whole life had been spent resisting a force as vast as the galaxy itself. I thrived on being the underdog. I grinned back, then teleported away. I appeared across the room, and as Braid sought me out, I slammed my hands down on the room's large metal desk. Her eyes went wide. I teleported the desk directly above her head. She didn't even get a chance to fire on me, as she was forced to jump away. I anticipated her, though, knowing in my gut that she'd jump to that table by the hologram. Its height would give her an excellent line of sight around the oval-shaped room. Even as the desk was crashing to the ground, generals, soldiers, and aides alike shouting and trying to make sense of the confusion, I hyperjumped. Braid emerged right where I'd thought she would, and I appeared behind her on the table, delivering a solid, full-knuckled punch straight to her kidneys. She screamed and spun, but I teleported across the room. I sought out her next tactically sound jump, the unexpected one, the one that would leave your enemy confused about where you might be. There, I thought, in the middle of the hologram. It still displayed fighters arrayed as dots of blue and red, larger capital ships hanging in the air and glowing bright as they traded volleys. As predicted, Braid appeared in the middle of it, using the holograms as cover. But as she tried to find me and shoot me, assuming I'd be distracted, I jumped next to her. This time, I punched her in the neck, then laid another fist into her stomach. She gasped and hyperjumped again. She wouldn't leave the room, though. That would be admitting defeat. And so I followed her,
the two of us jumping around the circular metal chamber as if in some bizarre children's game, using the other people as distractions or shields. In the midst of it all, the air warped and bent as my emotions surged. The exquisite energy of a fight churning inside of me, along with my anxiety for my friends and anger at Braid. A volcanic eruption of feelings pent up too long, held back for this moment. I would not be contained any longer. I would end this. Objects began to appear. Cups, rocks, data pads, one of the chairs from my old classroom. A chaotic mess of churning pieces of my life, mixing with the building intensity of the two of us leaping around the room, trying to pin one another down. I began to seize objects from the air as they materialized, throwing them anywhere I thought Braid would appear. I didn't pause to see if they connected, I just kept going. Flash, throw, flash, throw, flash, throw. Ouch! I leaped at that sound, coming out of the hyper jump in a bull rush and smashing her against the wall. Wow, Embot said in my head, his voice strong. Spencer, I had no idea you could move like that. I was a blur, a person between two worlds, continuously slipping from one to the other. Braid began firing wildly around the room, hitting her own people, her equipment, increasingly frantic as I grabbed panels off the walls, ripping the metal squares free by touching them, then teleporting them around her. They clanged as they landed, obscuring her view, always there when she jumped. Then I was among them, hitting her in the kidney again, then grabbing her gun and teleporting it away, then grabbing her and sending her into the vacuum. She came back a second later, of course, but she seemed panicked, disoriented. I leaped for her, growling, as if I were some feral beast, half human, half Delver. She got a shot off and grazed me on the shoulder. Her pistol? Where had that come from? I teleported it out into the vacuum. Oh, right. Maybe sending her to the same spot hadn't been my smartest move. Fortunately, the pain only focused my fury, and I threw her to the ground. When she hyperjumped, I teleported into the air just above her and fell down on her prone form, slamming an elbow into her face. When she hyperjumped away this time, she left blood on the floor. You bastard! She shouted as she appeared again, the broken desk between us. You half-civilized, miserable excuse for... She cut off as I appeared and, using the same move I'd performed on Jorgen all those months ago, slammed my fist into her knee and dropped her. I went for her throat again, knowing I could outlast her. She was stronger, had more resources, but I would never stop. I was vengeance incarnate. I was death. A flash bathed the room in blue light. At first, I kept fighting, thinking it was some distraction. Then I heard the radio chatter, the calls of victory from the enemy generals and ships. I saw the smile on Braid's face, her split lip trailing blood, victory in her eyes. Didn't you say, she asked me, that your grandmother was on that ship? I looked again, focusing on the hologram, watching as the flashes built up. Bursts of light announcing the final demise of an enormous capital ship. The Defiant was exploding. Chapter 46, Jorgen. Jorgen was left with the image of Becca Nightshade settling down into the captain's chair of the Defiant. Confident, smiling. That was the last transmission from the bridge as the ship went up. He saluted the blank wall as, beside him in the hologram, the Defiant died. Somber Kitson hovered up around him on platforms, over a dozen of them, and they offered a salute that he'd never seen before. A knife out, held up to the side, heads bowed. A final farewell to a warrior who died in glory. Personally, he'd never fully subscribed to the Defiant attitude of sacrifice among his people. He found it uncomfortable sometimes how they celebrated death, and he knew for a fact it had led to the untimely demise of people he'd loved. But today, he thought he understood it. Rebecca Nightshade hadn't thrown her life away. No ship was allowed, by galactic law and deep internal programming, to fly itself. No AI could be allowed to give commands or perform maneuvers without someone on the bridge. So she'd remained defiant in the face of overwhelming odds. In so doing, she'd given them all something amazing. A chance. The entire complement of the anti-planetary bombardment platforms around Detritus vanished, hyper-jumping as the captive slugs gave them the opportunity into the tiny column of open space behind the dying flagship. Gun emplacements that now hung in space, exposed. But they didn't need protection, because the enemy had committed all of its ships, carriers, destroyers, gunships, and fighters, to attack. They were lined up, completely distracted by taking their prize.
"All guns," Jorgen announced, lowering his arm from the salute. "Fire!"
Enormous beams of destructor fire blasted from the gathered gun platforms of Detritus, cutting through the remnants of the Defiant, piercing the very dust, debris, and burning light of its pyre. It had been Gran Gran's plan to send her fighters away, to leave herself defenseless, to limp back, knowing that the enemy would follow, that they'd be reckless in their determination to bring her down and would ignore what the fighters were doing. Jorgen's shots passed through the corpse of the Defiant and slammed into the enemy fleet, warping shields, overloading them with blast after blast. The enemy, of course, tried to hyperjump away, but per Gran Gran's instructions, the half of the Defiant fighters that had scattered chaotically swung back around toward the enemy. And if there was one thing that Jorgen's forces had, it was superior fighters. They converged on the enemy capital ships, bearing Kitson cytonics and slugs, inhibitors. In that moment, the battle reversed. The enemy, overconfident, had sent its fighters to bring down the Defiant's shields, and in so doing, left their fleet undefended. They'd assumed that Jorgen's fighters were too few in number to do any damage or bring down their own shields. They were right, but Jorgen didn't need to worry about that. Not when he had Detritus's gun platforms and their powerful beam weapons. All he needed was the enemy lined up, unable to jump away. And so, within moments of her passing, the hero, Rebecca Nightshade, got her revenge. The entire enemy fleet went up in blasts of light, like stars being born.